Stories from Fires. For Tess Gallagher. And isn't the past inevitable, now that we call the little we remember of it the past? William Matthews, Flood. The lie. It's a lie, my wife said. How could you believe such a thing? She's jealous, that's all. She tossed her head and kept staring at me. She hadn't yet taken off her hat and coat. Her face was flushed from the accusation. You believe me, don't you? Surely you don't believe that. I shrugged. Then I said, why should she lie? Where would it get her? What would she have to gain by lying? I was uncomfortable. I stood there in my slippers, opening and closing my hands, feeling a little ridiculous and on display in spite of the circumstances. I'm not cut out to play the Inquisitor. I wish now it had never reached my ears, that everything could have been as before. She's supposed to be a friend, I said. A friend to both of us. She's a bitch, is what she is. You don't think a friend, however poor a friend, even a chance acquaintance, would tell a thing like that, such an outright lie, do you? You simply can't believe it. She shook her head at my folly. Then she unpinned her hat, pulled off her gloves, laid everything on the table. She removed her coat and dropped it over the back of a chair. I don't know what to believe anymore, I said. I want to believe you. Then do, she said. Believe me, that's all I'm asking. I'm telling you the truth. I wouldn't lie about something like that. There now. Say it isn't true, darling. Say you don't believe it. I love her. I wanted to take her in my arms, hold her, tell her I believed her. But the lie, if it was a lie, had come between us. I moved over to the window. You must believe me, she said. You know this is stupid. You know I'm telling you the truth. I stood at the window and looked down at the traffic moving slowly below. If I raised my eyes, I could see my wife's reflection in the window. I'm a broad-minded man, I told myself. I can work this through. I began to think about my wife, about our life together, about truth versus fiction. Honesty opposed to falsehood, illusion and reality. I thought about that movie Blow Up we'd recently seen. Note: Blow Up, film, 1966, by Italian director Michelangelo Antonioni, 1912 to 2007, based loosely on a Julio Cortázar short story. End of note. I remembered the biography of Leo Tolstoy that lay on the coffee table, the things he says about truth, the splash he'd made in old Russia. Then I recalled a friend from long ago, a friend I'd had in my junior and senior years of high school, a friend who could never tell the truth, a chronic, unmitigated liar, yet a pleasant, well-meaning person, and a true friend for 2 or 3 years during a difficult period in my life. I was overjoyed with my discovery of this habitual liar from out of my past, this precedent to draw upon for aid in the present crisis in our, up to now, happy marriage. This person, this spirited liar, could indeed bear out my wife's theory that there were such people in the world. I was happy again. I turned around to speak. I knew what I wanted to say. Yes, indeed, it could be true. It is true. People can and do lie, uncontrollably, perhaps unconsciously, pathologically at times, without thought to the consequences. Surely my informant was such a person. But just at that moment, my wife sat down on the sofa, covered her face with her hands, and said, "It's true. God forgive me. Everything she told you was true. It was a lie when I said I didn't know anything about it." "Is that true?" I said. I sat down in one of the chairs near the window. She nodded. She kept her hands over her face. I said, "Why did you deny it, then? We never lie to one another. Haven't we always told each other the truth?" "I was sorry," she said. She looked at me and shook her head. I was ashamed. You don't know how ashamed I was. I didn't want you to believe it.
I think I understand, I said. She kicked off her shoes and leaned back on the sofa. Then she sat up and tugged her sweater over her head. She patted her hair into place. She took one of the cigarettes from the tray. I held the lighter for her and was momentarily astonished by the sight of her slim, pale fingers and her well-manicured nails. It was as if I were seeing them in a new and somehow revealing way. She drew on the cigarette and said after a minute,
And how was your day today, sweet? Generally speaking, that is. You know what I mean.
She held the cigarette between her lips and stood up for a minute to step out of her skirt.
There,
she said. It was so-so, I answered. There was a policeman here in the afternoon with a warrant, believe it or not, looking for someone who used to live down the hall. And the apartment manager himself called to say the water would be shut off for a half hour between 3 and 3:30 while they made repairs. In fact, come to think of it, it was just during the time the policeman was here that they had to shut off the water.
Is that so?
She said. She put her hands on her hips and stretched. Then she closed her eyes, yawned, and shook her long hair. And I read a good portion of the Tolstoy book today, I said.
Marvelous.
She began to eat cocktail nuts, tossing them one after the other with her right hand into her open mouth, while still holding the cigarette between the fingers of her left hand. From time to time, she stopped eating long enough to wipe her lips with the back of her hand and draw on the cigarette. She'd slipped out of her underthings by now. She doubled her legs under her and settled into the sofa.
How is it?
She said. He had some interesting ideas, I said. He was quite a character. My fingers tingled and the blood was beginning to move faster, but I felt weak, too.
Come here, my little mujik, she said. Note, mujik, Russian, peasant. End of note.
I want the truth, I said faintly, on my hands and knees now. The plush, springy softness of the carpet excited me. Slowly, I crawled over to the sofa and rested my chin on one of the cushions. She ran her hand through my hair. She was still smiling. Grains of salt glimmered on her full lips. But as I watched, her eyes filled with a look of inexpressible sadness, though she continued smiling and stroking my hair.
Little Pasha, she said. Come up here, dumpling. Did it really believe that nasty lady, that nasty lie? Here, put your head on mommy's breast. That's it. Now close your eyes. There. How could it believe such a thing? I'm disappointed in you. Really, you know me better than that. Lying is just a sport for some people.
The cabin. Mr. Harold came out of the cafe to find it had stopped snowing. The sky was clearing behind the hills on the other side of the river. He stopped beside the car for a minute and stretched, holding the car door open while he drew a big mouthful of cold air. He'd swear he could almost taste this air. He eased in behind the steering wheel and got back on the highway. It was only an hour's drive to the lodge. He could get in a couple of hours of fishing this afternoon. Then there was tomorrow, all day tomorrow. At Park Junction, he took the bridge over the river and turned off onto the road that would take him to the lodge. Pine trees whose branches were heavy with snow stood on either side of the road. Clouds mantled the white hills so that it was hard to tell where the hills ended and the sky began. It reminded him of those Chinese landscapes they'd looked at that time in the museum in Portland. He liked them. He'd said as much to Frances, but she didn't say anything back. She'd spent a few minutes with him in that wing of the gallery and then moved on to the next exhibit. It was going on noon when he reached the lodge. He saw the cabins up on the hill and then, as the road straightened out, the lodge itself. He slowed, bumped off the road onto the dirty, sand-covered parking lot, and stopped the car up close to the front door. He rolled down the window and rested for a minute, working his shoulders back and forth into the seat. He closed and then opened his eyes. A flickering neon sign said Castle Rock, and below that, on a neat, hand-painted sign, Deluxe Cabins, Office. The last time he'd been here, Francis had been with him that time, they'd stayed for 4 days, and he'd landed 5 nice fish downriver. That had been 3 years ago. They used to come here often, 2 or 3 times a year. He opened the door and got out of the car slowly, feeling the stiffness in his back and neck. He walked heavily across the frozen snow and stuck his hands in his coat pockets as he started up the planked steps. At the top, he scraped the snow and grit off his shoes and nodded to a young couple coming out. He noticed the way the man held the woman's arm as they went down the steps. Inside the lodge, there was the smell of wood smoke and fried ham. He heard the clatter of dishes. He looked at the big brown trout mounted over the fireplace in the dining room, and he felt glad to be back. Near the cash register, where he stood, was a display case with leather purses, wallets, and pairs of moccasins arranged behind the glass. Scattered around on top of the case were Indian bead necklaces and bracelets and pieces of petrified wood. He moved over to the horseshoe-shaped counter and took a stool. 2 men sitting a few stools down stopped talking and turned their heads to look at him. They were hunters, and their red hats and coats lay on an empty table behind them. Mr. Harold waited and pulled at his fingers.
"How long you been here?"
the girl asked, frowning. She'd come on him soundlessly from the kitchen. She put down a glass of water in front of him. "Not long," Mr. Harold said.
"You should have rung the bell," she said.
Her braces glittered as she opened and closed her mouth. "I'm supposed to have a cabin," he said. "I wrote you a card and made a reservation a week or so ago."
"I'll have to get Mrs. May," the girl said. "She's cooking. She's the one who looks after the cabins. She didn't say anything to me about it. We don't usually keep them open in the winter, you know."
"I wrote you a card," he said. "You check with Mrs. May. You ask her about it." The 2 men had turned on their stools to look at him again.
"I'll get Mrs. May," the girl said.
Flushed, he closed his hands together on the counter in front of him. A big Frederick Remington reproduction hung on the wall at the far end of the room. He watched the lurching, frightened buffalo and the Indians with the drawn bows fixed at their shoulders.
"Mr. Harold," the old woman called, hobbling toward him. She was a small, gray-haired woman with heavy breasts and a fat throat. The straps to her underwear showed through her white uniform. She undid her apron and held out her hand.
"Glad to see you, Mrs. May," he said as he got up off the stool.
"I hardly recognized you," the old woman said. "I don't know what's the matter with the girl sometimes. Edith. She's my granddaughter. My daughter and her husband are looking after the place now."
She took her glasses off and began wiping away the steam from the lenses. He looked down at the polished counter. He smoothed his fingers over the grainy wood.
"Where's the missus?" she asked.
"She didn't feel too well this week," Mr. Harold said. He started to say something else, but there was nothing else to say.
"I'm sorry to hear that. I had the cabin fixed up nice for the 2 of you,
Mrs. May said. She took off the apron and put it behind the cash register.
"Edith? I'm taking Mr. Harold to his cabin." "I'll have to get my coat, Mr. Harold."
The girl didn't answer, but she came to the kitchen door with a coffee pot in her hand and stared at them. Outside, the sun had come out and the glare hurt his eyes. He held on to the banister and went slowly down the stairs, following Mrs. May, who limped.
"Sun's bad, isn't it?"
she said, moving carefully over the packed snow. He felt she ought to be using a cane.
"The first time it's been out all week," she said.
She waved at some people going by in a car. They went past a gasoline pump, locked and covered with snow, and past a little shed with a tires sign hung over the door. He looked through the broken windows at the heaps of burlap sacks inside, the old tires and the barrels. The room was damp and cold-looking. Snow had drifted inside and lay sprinkled on the sill around the broken glass.
"Kids have done that," Mrs. May said, stopping for a minute and putting her hand up to the broken window. "They don't miss a chance to do us dirt. A whole pack of them are all the time running wild from down at the construction camp."
She shook her head.
"Poor little devils. Sorry home life for kids anyway, always on the move like that. Their daddies are building on that dam."
She unlocked the cabin door and pushed on it.
"I laid a little fire this morning so it would be nice for you," she said.
"I appreciate that, Mrs. May," he said.
There was a big double bed covered with a plain bedspread, a bureau, and a desk in the front room which was divided from the kitchen by a little plywood partition. There was also a sink, wood stove, wood box, an old ice box, an oilcloth-covered table, and two wooden chairs. A door opened to a bathroom. He saw a little porch to one side where he could hang his clothes.
"Looks fine," he said.
"I tried to make it as nice as I could," she said. "Do you need anything now, Mr. Harold?"
"Not now, anyway, thanks," he said.
"I'll let you rest, then. You're probably tired driving all that way," she said.
"I should bring in my things," Mr. Harold said, following her out.
He shut the door behind them, and they stood on the porch looking down the hill.
"I'm just sorry your wife couldn't come," the old woman said.
He didn't answer. From where they stood, they were almost on a level with the huge rock protruding from the hillside behind the road. Some people said it looked like a petrified castle.
"How's the fishing?" he said.
"Some of them are getting fish, but most of the men are out hunting," she said. "Deer season, you know."
He drove the car as close as he could to the cabin and started to unload. The last thing he took out of the car was a pint of scotch from the glove compartment. He set the bottle on the table. Later, as he spread out the boxes of weights and hooks and thick-bodied red and white flies, he moved the bottle to the drain board. Sitting there at the table, smoking a cigarette with his tackle box open and everything in its place, his flies and the weights spread out, testing leader strength between his hands and tying up outfits for that afternoon, he was glad he'd come after all. And he'd still be able to get in a couple of hours fishing this afternoon. Then there was tomorrow. He'd already decided he would save some of the bottle for when he came back from fishing that afternoon and have the rest for tomorrow. As he sat at the table tying up outfits, he thought he heard something digging out on the porch. He got up from the table and opened the door, but there was nothing there. There were only the white hills and the dead-looking pines under the overcast sky and, down below, the few buildings and some cars drawn up beside the highway. He was all at once very tired and thought he would lie down on the bed for a few minutes. He didn't want to sleep. He'd just lie down and rest, and then he'd get up, dress, take his things, and walk down to the river. He cleaned off the table, undressed, and then got in between the cold sheets. For a while he lay on his side, eyes closed, knees drawn up for warmth. Then he turned onto his back and wiggled his toes against the sheet. He wished Francis were here. He wished there was somebody to talk to. He opened his eyes. The room was dark. The stove gave off little crackling noises, and there was a red glow on the wall behind the stove. He lay in bed and stared at the window, not able to believe it was really dark outside. He shut his eyes again and then opened them. He'd only wanted to rest. He hadn't intended to fall asleep. He opened his eyes and sat up heavily on the side of the bed. He got on his shirt and reached for his pants. He went into the bathroom and threw water on his face.
"God damn it," he said, banging things around in the kitchen cupboard, taking down some cans and putting them back again.
He made a pot of coffee and drank two cups before deciding to go down to the cafe for something to eat. He put on wool slippers and a coat and hunted around until he found his flashlight. Then he went outside. The cold air stung his cheeks and pinched his nostrils together. The air felt good to him. It cleared his head. The lights from the lodge showed him where he was walking, and he was careful. Inside the cafe, he nodded to the girl, Edith, and sat down in a booth near the end of the counter. He could hear a radio playing back in the kitchen. The girl made no effort to wait on him.
Are you closed?
Mr. Harold said.
Kind of. I'm cleaning up for the morning, she said.
Too late for something to eat, then, he said.
I guess I can get you something, she said.
She came over with a menu.
Mrs. May around, Edith?
She's up in her room. Did you need her for something?
I need more wood, for in the morning.
It's out in back, she said. Right here behind the kitchen.
He pointed to something simple on the menu. A ham sandwich with potato salad.
I'll have this, he said.
As he waited, he began moving the salt and pepper shakers around in a little circle in front of him. After she brought his plate to him, she hung around out in front, filling sugar bowls and napkin holders, looking up at him from time to time. Pretty soon, before he'd finished, she came over with a wet rag and began wiping off his table. He left some money, considerably more than the bill, and went out through a door at the side of the lodge. He went around back where he picked up an armload of wood. Then the snail's pace climb up to the cabin. He looked back once and saw the girl watching him from the kitchen window. By the time he got to his door and dropped the wood, he hated her. He lay on the bed for a long time and read old Life magazines that he'd found on the porch. When the heat from the fire finally made him sleepy, he got up and cleared off his bed, then arranged his things for the next morning. He looked through the pile of stuff again to make sure he had everything. He liked things in order and didn't want to have to get up the next morning and have to look for something. He picked up the scotch and held the bottle up to the light. Then he poured some into a cup. He carried the cup over to the bed and set it on the nightstand. He turned off the light and stood looking out the window for a minute before getting into bed. He got up so early it was still almost dark in the cabin. The fire had gone down to coals during the night. He could see his breath in the cabin. He adjusted the grate and pushed in some wood. He couldn't remember the last time he'd gotten up so early. He fixed peanut butter sandwiches and wrapped them in waxed paper. He put the sandwiches and some oatmeal cookies into a coat pocket. At the door, he pulled on his waders. The light outside was vague and gray. Clouds filled the long valleys and hung in patches over the trees and mountains. The lodge was dark. He moved out slowly down the packed, slippery trail toward the river. It pleased him to be up this early and to be going fishing. Somewhere in one of the valleys off behind the river, he heard the pop-pop of shots and counted them. 7, 8. The hunters were awake. And the deer. He wondered if the shots came from the 2 hunters he'd seen in the lodge yesterday. Deer didn't have much of a chance in snow like this. He kept his eyes down, watching the trail. It kept dropping downhill, and soon he was in heavy timber with snow up to his ankles. Snow lay in drifts under the trees, but it wasn't too deep where he walked. It was a good trail, packed solid, thick with pine needles that crunched into the snow under his boots. He could see his breath streaming out in front of him. He held the fishing rod straight ahead of him when he had to push through the bushes or go under trees with low limbs. He held the rod by its big reel, tucked up under his arm like a lance. Sometimes, back when he was a kid and had gone into a remote area to fish for 2 or 3 days at a time, hiking in by himself, he'd carried his rod like this, even when there was no brush or trees, maybe just a big green meadow. Those times he would imagine himself waiting for his opponent to ride out of the trees on a horse. The jays at the crowded edge of the woods would scream. Then he'd sing something as loud as he could, yell defiance until his chest hurt, at the hawks that circled and circled over the meadow. The sun and the sky came back to him now, and the lake with the lean-to. The water so clear and green you could see 15 or 20 feet down to where it shelved off into deeper water. He could hear the river. But the trail was gone now, and just before he started down the bank to the river, he stepped into a snowdrift up over his knees and panicked, clawing up handfuls of snow and vines to get out. The river looked impossibly cold. It was silver green in color, and there was ice on the little pools and the rocks along the edge. Before, In the summer, he'd caught his fish further downriver. But he couldn't go downriver this morning. This morning, he was simply glad to be where he was. 100 feet away, on the other side of the river, lay a beach with a nice riffle running just in front of the beach. But of course, there was no way of getting over there. He decided he was just fine where he was. He lifted up onto a log, positioned himself there, and looked around. He saw tall trees and snow-covered mountains. He thought it was pretty as a picture, the way the steam lay over the river. He sat there on the log, swinging his legs back and forth while he threaded the line through the guides of his rod. He tied on one of the outfits he'd made up last night. When everything was ready, he slipped down off the log, pulled the rubber boots up over his legs as high as they'd go, and fastened the buckle tops of the waders to his belt. He waded slowly into the river, holding his breath for the cold water shock. The water hit and, swirling, braced against him up to his knees. He stopped, then he moved out a little further. He took the brake off his reel and made a nice cast upstream. As he fished, he began to feel some of the old excitement coming back. He kept on fishing. After a time, he waded out and sat down on a rock with his back against a log. He took out the cookies. He wasn't going to hurry anything. Not today. A flock of small birds flew from across the river and perched on some rocks close to where he was sitting. They rose when he scattered a handful of crumbs toward them. The tops of the trees creaked, and the wind was drawing the clouds up out of the valley and over the hills. Then he heard a spatter of shots from somewhere in the forest across the river. He just changed flies and made his cast when he saw the deer. It stumbled out of the brush upriver and ran onto the little beach, shaking and twisting its head, ropes of white mucus hanging from its nostrils. Its left hind leg was broken and dragged behind as, for an instant, the deer stopped and turned her head back to look at it. Then she went into the river and out into the current until only her back and head were visible. She reached the shallow water on his side and came out clumsily, moving her head from side to side. He stood very still and watched her plunge into the trees. "Dirty bastards," he said. He made another cast. Then he reeled in and made his way back to the shore. He sat down in the same place on the log and ate his sandwich. It was dry and it didn't have any taste to it, but he ate it anyway and tried not to think about the deer. Francis would be up now, doing things around the house. He didn't want to think about Francis either. But he remembered that morning when he'd caught the 3 steelhead. It was all he could do to carry them up the hill to their cabin. But he had, and when she came to the door, he'd emptied them out of the sack onto the steps in front of her. She'd whistled and bent down to touch the black spots that ran along their backs, and he'd gone back that afternoon and caught 2 more. It had turned colder. The wind was blowing down the river. He got up stiffly and hobbled over the rocks, trying to loosen up. He thought about building a fire, but then decided he wouldn't stay much longer. Some crows flapped by overhead, coming from across the river. When they were over him, he yelled, but they didn't even look down. He changed flies again, added more weight, and cast upstream. He let the current draw the line through his fingers until he saw it go slack. Then he set the brake on his reel. The pencil-lead weight bounced against the rocks under the water. He held the butt of the rod against his stomach and wondered how the fly might look to a fish. Several boys came out of the trees upriver and walked onto the beach. Some of them were wearing red hats and down vests. They moved around on the beach, looking at Mr. Harold and then looking up and down the river. When they began moving down the beach in his direction, Mr. Harold looked up at the hills, then downriver to where the best water was. He began to reel in. He caught his fly and set the hook into the cork above the reel. Then he started easing his way back toward the shore, thinking only of the shore and that each careful step brought him 1 step closer. "Hey!" He stopped and turned slowly around in the water, wishing this thing had happened when he was on the shore and not out here with the water pushing against his legs and him off balance on the slippery rocks. His feet wedged themselves down between rocks while he kept his eyes on them until he'd picked out the leader. All of them wore what looked like holsters or knife sheaths on their belts. But only one boy had a rifle. It was, he knew, the boy who'd called to him, gaunt and thin-faced, wearing a brown duck-billed cap, the boy said.
You see a deer come out up there?
The boy held the gun in his right hand as if it were a pistol and pointed the barrel up the beach. One of the boys said,
Sure he did, Earl. It ain't been very long.
And looked around at the four others. They nodded. They passed round a cigarette and kept their eyes on him.
I said, Hey, you deaf? I said, did you see him?
It wasn't a him, it was a her,
Mr. Harold said.
And her back leg was almost shot off, for Christ's sake.
What's that to you?
The one with the gun said.
He's pretty smart, ain't he, Earl? Tell us where it went, you old son of a bitch,
one of the boys said.
Where'd he go?
The boy asked, and raised the gun to his hip, half pointing it across at Mr. Harold.
Who wants to know?
He held the rod straight ahead, tied up under his arm, and with his other hand he pulled down his hat.
You little bastards are from that trailer camp up the river, aren't you?
You think you know a lot, don't you?
The boy said, looking around him at the others, nodding at them. He raised up one foot and set it down slowly, then the other. In a moment, he raised the rifle to his shoulder and pulled back the hammer. The barrel was pointed at Mr. Harold's stomach, or else a little lower down. The water swirled and foamed around his boots. He opened and closed his mouth, but he was not able to move his tongue. He looked down into the clear water at the little rocks and the little spaces of sand. He wondered what it would be like if his boots tipped water and he went down, rolling like a chunk.
What's the matter with you?
He asked the boy. The ice water came up through his legs and then poured into his chest. The boy didn't say anything. He just stood there. All of them just stood there looking at him.
Don't shoot,
Mr. Harold said. The boy held the gun on him for another minute, then he lowered it.
Scared, wasn't you?
Mr. Harold nodded his head dreamily. He felt as if he wanted to yawn. He kept opening and closing his mouth. One of the boys pried loose a rock from the edge of the water and threw it. Mr. Harold turned his back and the rock hit the water 2 feet away from him. The others began throwing. He stood there looking at the shore, hearing the rocks splash around him.
You didn't want to fish here anyway, did you?
The boy said.
I could have got you, but I didn't. You see that deer? You remember how lucky you was.
Mr. Harold stood there a minute longer. Then he looked over his shoulder. One of the boys gave him the finger, and the rest of them grinned. Then they moved together back into the trees. He watched them go. He turned and worked his way back to the shore and dropped down against the log. After a few minutes, he got up and started the walk back to the cabin. The snow had held back all morning, and now, just as he was in sight of the clearing, light flakes began falling. His rod was back there somewhere. Maybe he'd left it when he stopped that one time after he turned his ankle. He could remember laying the rod on the snow as he tried to undo his boot, but he didn't recall picking it up. Anyway, it didn't matter to him now. It was a good rod and one that he'd paid over $90 for one summer 5 or 6 years ago. But even if it were nice tomorrow, he wouldn't go back for it. Tomorrow? He had to be back home and at work tomorrow. A jay cried from a nearby tree, and another answered from across the clearing by his cabin. He was tired and walking slowly by now, trying to keep weight off his foot. He came out of the trees and stopped. Lights were on down at the lodge. Even the lights in the parking area were on. There were still many hours of daylight left, but they had turned on all the lights down there. This seemed mysterious and impenetrable to him. Had something happened? He shook his head. Then he went up the steps to his cabin. He stopped on the porch. He didn't want to go inside, but he understood he had to open the door and enter the room. He didn't know if he could do that. He thought for a minute of just getting into his car and driving away. He looked once more down the hill at the lights. Then he grasped the doorknob and opened the door to his cabin. Someone, Mrs. May, he supposed, had built a little fire in the stove. Still, he looked around cautiously. It was quiet, except for the sizzling of the fire. He sat down on the bed and began to work off his boots. Then he sat there in his stocking feet, thinking of the river and of the large fish that must even now be moving upriver in that heart-stopping cold water. He shook his head, got up, and held his hands a few inches from the stove, opening and closing his fingers until they tingled. He let the warmth gradually come back into his body. He began to think of home, of getting back there before dark. Harry's death. Mazatlan, Mexico, 3 months later.
Everything has changed since Harry's death. Being down here, for instance. Who'd have thought it? Only 3 short months ago, that I'd be down here in Mexico and poor Harry dead and buried. Harry. Dead and buried. But not forgotten. I couldn't go to work that day when I got the news. I was just too torn up. Jack Berger, who is the fender and body man at Frank's Custom Repair, where we all work, called me at 6:30 a.m. as I was having a cup of coffee and a cigarette before sitting down to breakfast.
Harry's dead,
he said just like that, dropping the bomb.
Turn on your radio,
he said.
Turn on your TV.
The police had just left his house after asking Jack a lot of questions about Harry. They'd told him to come down right away and identify the body. Jack said they'd probably come to my place next. Why they went to Jack Berger's place first is a mystery to me, since he and Harry weren't what you'd say close. Not as close anyway as Harry and me. I couldn't believe it, but I knew it must be true for Jack to call. I felt like I was in shock and forgot all about breakfast. I turned from one news broadcast to another until I had the story. I must have hung around an hour or so listening to the radio and getting more and more upset as I thought about Harry and what the radio was saying. There would be a lot of crummy people who wouldn't be sorry to see Harry dead. Would be glad he'd bought it, in fact. His wife, for one, would be glad, though she lived in San Diego and they hadn't seen each other for 2 or 3 years. She'd be glad. She's that kind of person, from what Harry had said. She didn't want to give him the divorce for another woman. No divorce, nothing. Now she wouldn't have to worry about it anymore. No, she wouldn't be sorry to see Harry dead. But little Judith, that's another story. I left the house after calling in at work to report off. Frank didn't say much. He said he could understand. He felt the same way, he said, but he had to keep the shop open. Harry would have wanted it that way, he said. Frank Clovey. He's the owner and shop foreman rolled into one. And the best man I ever worked for. I got in the car and started off in the general direction of the Red Fox, a place where Harry and myself and Gene Smith and Rod Williams and Ned Clark and some of the rest of the gang hung out nights after work. It was 8:30 in the morning by then, and the traffic was heavy, so I had to keep my mind on my driving. Still, I couldn't help thinking now and then about poor Harry. Harry was an operator. That is to say, he always had something going. It was never a drag being around Harry. He was good with women, if you know what I mean. Always had money and lived high. He was sharp, too, and somehow he could always work it around so that in any deal he came out smelling like a rose. The Jag he drove, for instance. It was nearly new. A $20,000 car, but it had been wrecked in a big pile-up on 101. Harry bought it for a song from the insurance company and fixed it up himself till it was like new. That's the kind of guy Harry was. Then there's this 32-foot Chris Craft cabin cruiser that Harry's uncle in L.A. had left Harry in his will. Harry'd only had the boat about a month. He'd just gone down to look it over and take it out for a little spin a couple of weeks ago. But there was the problem of Harry's wife, who was legally entitled to her share. To keep her from somehow getting her hands on it if she got wind of it, before he'd even laid eyes on the boat, in fact. Harry had gone to a lawyer and worked something out so that he signed the thing over, lock, stock, and pickle barrel to little Judith. The two of them had been planning to take it for a trip someplace on Harry's vacation in August. Harry had been all over, I might add. He'd been to Europe when he was in the service and had been to all the capitals and big resort cities. He'd been in a crowd once when someone took a shot at General de Gaulle. He'd been places and done things, Harry had. Now he was dead. At the Red Fox, which opens early, there was only one guy in the place. He was sitting at the other end of the bar, and he was no one I knew. Jimmy, the bartender, had the television on and nodded at me as I came in. His eyes were red, and it came home to me hard, Harry's death, when I saw Jimmy. There was an old Lucille Ball Desi Arnaz show just starting, and Jimmy took a long stick and turned the channel selector to another station, but there was nothing on right now about Harry.
I can't believe it, Jimmy said, shaking his head. Anybody but Harry.
I feel the same way, Jimmy, I said. Anybody but Harry. Jimmy poured us two stiff ones and threw his off without batting an eye.
It hurts as bad as if Harry'd been my own brother. It couldn't hurt any worse.
He shook his head again and stared a while at his glass. He was pretty far gone already.
We'd better have another one, he said.
Put a little water in mine this time, I said. A few guys, friends of Harry's, drifted in from time to time that morning. Once I saw Jimmy get out a handkerchief and blow his nose. The guy at the other end of the bar, the stranger, made a move as if to play something on the jukebox. But Jimmy went over and pulled the plug with a wild jerk and glared at the guy till he left. None of us had much to say to each other. What could we say? We were still too numb. Finally, Jimmy brought out an empty cigar box and put it on the bar. He said we'd better start a collection for a wreath. We all put in a dollar or two to get things going. Jimmy took a grease pencil and marked Harry Fund on the box. Mike Demarest came in and took the stool next to mine. He's a bartender at the TNT Club.
Cripes, he said. I heard it on the clock radio. The wife was getting dressed for work and woke me up and said, is that the Harry you know? Sure as hell. Give me a double and a beer chaser, Jimmy.
In a few minutes, he said.
How's little Judith taking it? Has anybody seen little Judith?
I could see he was watching me out of the corner of his eye. I didn't have anything to say to him. Jimmy said,
she called here this morning and sounded pretty hysterical, poor kid.
After another drink or two, Mike turned to me and said,
you going down to view him?
I waited for a minute before answering. I don't care much for that sort of thing. I doubt it. Mike nodded as if he understood. But a minute later, I caught him watching me in the mirror behind the bar. I might put in here that I don't like Mike Demarest, if you haven't already guessed.
I have never liked him.
Harry didn't like him either. We'd talked about it, but that's the way it always is. The good guys get it, and the other guys go about their business. About then, I noticed my palms were getting clammy and my insides felt like lead. At the same time, I could feel the blood pounding hard in my temples. For a minute, I thought I was going to faint. I slid off the stool, nodded at Mike, and said, take it easy, Jimmy.
Yeah, you too,
he said. Outside, I leaned against the wall for a minute, trying to get my bearings. I remembered I hadn't had any breakfast. What with the anxiety and depression and the drinks I'd had, it was no wonder my head was spinning. But I didn't want anything to eat. I couldn't have eaten a bite for anything. A clock over a jewelry store window across the street said 10 to 11. It seemed like it should be late afternoon at least. So much had happened. It was at that moment I saw little Judith. She came around the corner walking slowly, her shoulders hunched and drawn, a pinched look to her face. A pitiful sight. She had a big wad of Kleenex in her hand. She stopped once and blew her nose. Judith, I said. She made a sound that went to my heart like a bullet. We put our arms around each other right there on the sidewalk. I said, Judith, I'm so sorry. What can I do? I'd give my right arm, you know that. She nodded. She couldn't say anything. We stood there patting and rubbing each other, me trying to console her, saying whatever came to mind, both of us sniffling. She let go for a minute and looked at me with a dazed look. Then she threw her arms around me again.
I can't believe it, that's all,
she said.
I just can't.
She kept squeezing my shoulder with one hand and patting my back with the other. It's true, Judith, I said. It's on the radio and TV news, and it'll be in all the papers tonight.
No, no,
she said, squeezing me all the harder. I was beginning to get woozy again. I could feel the sun burning down on my head. She still had her arms around me. I moved just enough so that we had to pull apart, but I kept my arm around her waist to give her support.
We were going away next month, she said. Last night we sat at our table in the Red Fox for 3 or 4 hours making plans.
Judith, I said, let's go someplace and have a cup of coffee or a drink.
Let's go inside, she said.
No, someplace else, I said. We can come back here later.
I think if I ate something, I might feel better, she said.
That's a good idea, I said. I could eat something. The next 3 days passed in a whirl. I went to work each day, but it was a sad and depressing place without Harry. I saw a lot of little Judith after work. I sat with her in the evenings and tried to keep her from dwelling on too many unpleasant aspects of the thing. I also took her around here and there for things she had to attend to. Twice I took her to the funeral parlor. She collapsed the first time. I wouldn't go inside the place myself. I wanted to remember poor Harry as he used to be. The day before the service, all of us at the shop chipped in $38 for a funeral spray. I was delegated to go and pick it out since I'd been close to Harry. I remembered a florist's not far from my place. So I drove home, fixed some lunch, then drove to Howard's House of Flowers. It was in this shopping center along with a pharmacy, a barber shop, a bank, and a travel agency. I parked the car and hadn't taken more than a couple of steps when my eye was caught by this big poster in the travel agency window. I went over to the window and stood for a while. Mexico. There was this giant stone face grinning down like the sun over a blue sea filled with little sailboats that looked like white paper napkins. On the beach, women in bikinis lounged around in sunglasses or else played badminton. I looked at all the posters in the window, including those for Germany and Merry England, but I kept going back to that grinning sun, the beach, the women, and the little boats. Finally, I combed my hair in the reflection from the window, straightened my shoulders, and went on to the florist's. The next morning, Frank Clovey came to work wearing slacks, white shirt, and tie. He said if any of us wanted to go see Harry off, it was all right with him. Most of the guys went home to change, took in the funeral, and then took the rest of the afternoon off. Jimmy had set up a little buffet at the Red Fox in honor of Harry. He had different kinds of dip, potato chips, and sandwiches. I didn't go to the funeral, but I did drop by the Red Fox later in the afternoon. Little Judith was there, sure. She was dressed up and moving around the place like she'd had a heavy dose of shell shock. Mike Demarest was there, too, and I could see him looking her over from time to time. She went from one guy to another talking about Harry and saying things like,
Harry thought the world of you, Gus.
Or,
Harry would have wanted it that way.
Or,
Harry would have liked that part best. Harry was just that sort.
Two or three guys hugged her and patted her on the hips and carried on so that I almost asked them to leave off. A few old pods drifted in, guys that Harry probably hadn't exchanged a dozen words with in his life, if he'd ever even laid eyes on them, and said what a tragedy it was, and threw down beer and sandwiches. Little Judith and I stayed around till the place emptied out around 7. Then I took her home. You've probably guessed some of the rest of the story by now. Little Judith and I started keeping company after Harry's death. We went to the movies nearly every night, and then to a bar, or else to her place. We only went back to the Red Fox once, and then we decided not to go there anymore, but to go to new places instead. Places where she and Harry had never been. One Sunday, not long after the funeral, the two of us went out to Golden Gate Cemetery to put a pot of flowers on Harry's grave. But they hadn't put his marker in yet, so we spent an hour looking for it and were still not able to find the goddamn grave. Little Judith kept running around from one spot to another, calling,
"Here it is! Here it is!"
But the plot always turned out to belong to somebody else. We finally left, both of us feeling depressed. In August, we drove down to L.A. to have a look at the boat. It was a fine piece of work. Harry's uncle had kept it in prime shape, and Tomas, the Mexican boy who looked after it, said he wouldn't be afraid to take it around the world. Little Judith and I just looked at it and then looked at each other. It's seldom anything turns out to be better than you expected it to be. Usually it's the other way around. But that's the way it was with this boat. Better than anything we'd dreamed. On our way back to San Francisco, we decided to take it on a little cruise the next month. And so we set out on our trip in September, just before the Labor Day weekend. As I said, a lot of things have changed since Harry's death. Even little Judith is out of the picture now, gone in a way that is tragic and still has me wondering. It was somewhere off the Baja coast that it happened. Little Judith, who couldn't swim a stroke, came up missing. We figured she fell overboard during the night. What she was doing up on deck so late, or what caused her to fall overboard, neither Tomas nor I know. All we know is that the next morning she was gone, and neither of us saw anything or heard her cry out. She simply disappeared.
That is the truth, so help me, and what I told the police when we put in at Guaymas a few days later.
My wife, I told them, for luckily we'd married just before leaving San Francisco. It was to have been our honeymoon trip. I said things have changed since Harry's death. Now here I am in Mazatlan, and Tomas is showing me some of the sights. Things you never thought existed back in the States. Our next stop is Manzanillo, Tomas's hometown, then Acapulco. We intend to keep going until the money runs out, then put in and work for a while, then set out again. It occurs to me that I'm doing things the way Harry would have wanted. But who can tell about that now? Sometimes I think I was born to be a rover.
The Pheasant. Gerald Weber didn't have any words left in him. He kept quiet and drove the car. Shirley Leonard had stayed awake at first, for the novelty of it more than anything, the fact of being alone with him for any length of time. She'd put several cassettes on to play, Crystal Gayle, Chuck Mangione, Willie Nelson, and then later, toward morning, had begun dialing the radio from one station to another, picking up world and local news, brief weather and farm reports, even an early morning question and answer program on the effects of marijuana smoking on nursing mothers, anything to fill in the long silences. From time to time, smoking, she looked across at him through the dark gloom of the big car. Somewhere between San Luis Obispo and Potter, California, 150 miles or so from her summer house at Carmel, she gave up Gerald Weber as a bad investment. She'd made others, she reflected wearily, and fell asleep on the seat. He could hear her ragged breathing over the sound of the air that rushed by outside. He turned off the radio and was glad for the privacy. It had been a mistake to leave Hollywood in the middle of the night for a 300-mile drive, but that night, 2 days before his 30th birthday, he'd felt at loose ends and suggested that they drive up to her beach house for a few days. It was 10 o'clock and they were still drinking martinis, though they'd moved out to the patio that overlooked the city. "Why not?" she'd said, stirring the drink with her finger and looking at him where he stood against the balcony railing. "Let's. I think it's the best idea you've had all week," licking the gin off her finger. He took his eyes off the road. She didn't look asleep. She looked unconscious or seriously injured, as if she'd fallen out of a building. She lay twisted in the seat, one leg doubled under and the other hanging over the seat almost to the floor. The skirt was pulled above her thighs, exposing the tops of the nylons, the garter belt, and the flesh in between. Her head lay on the armrest and her mouth was open. It had rained off and on through the night. Now, just as it began to turn light, the rain stopped, although the highway was still damp and black and he could see small puddles of water lying in the depressions in the open fields on either side of the road. He wasn't tired yet. He felt all right, considering. He was glad to be doing something. It felt good to sit there behind the wheel, driving, not having to think. He had just turned off the headlights and decreased his speed a little when he saw the pheasant out of the corner of his eye. It was flying low and fast and at an angle that might take it into the path of the car. He touched the brake, then increased his speed and tightened his grip on the wheel. The bird struck the left headlamp with a loud thunk. It spun up past the windshield, trailing feathers and a stream of shit. "Oh my God," he said, appalled at what he'd done. "What's happened?" she said, sitting up heavily, wide-eyed and startled.
"I hit something. A pheasant."
He could hear the glass from the broken headlamp tinkling on the pavement as he braked the car. He pulled onto the shoulder and got out. The air was damp and cold, and he buttoned his sweater as he went over to inspect the damage. Except for a few jagged pieces of glass, which he tried for a minute with trembling fingers to loosen and work out, the headlamp was gone. There was also a small dent in the left front fender. In the dent, a smear of blood coated the metal and several dun-colored feathers were pressed into the blood. It was a hen pheasant. He'd seen that the moment before the impact. Shirley leaned over to his side of the car and pressed the button for the window. She was still half asleep. "Jerry?" she called to him.
"Just a minute. Just stay in the car," he said.
"I wasn't about to get out," she said. "Just hurry, I mean." He walked back along the shoulder. A truck went by, throwing up a mist of spray, and the driver looked out of the cab at him as he roared past. Jerry hunched his shoulders against the cold and kept walking until he came to the sprinkling of broken glass in the road. He walked further, looking closely into the wet grass beside the road, until he found the bird. He couldn't bring himself to touch it, but he looked at it for a minute, crumpled, its eyes open, a bright spot of blood on its beak. When he was back in the car, Shirley said, "I didn't know what had happened. Did it do much damage?"
"It knocked out a headlight and made a little dent in the fender," he said.
He looked back the way they'd come, and then pulled out onto the road. "Did it kill it?" she said. "I mean, it must have, of course. I suppose it didn't have a chance." He looked at her and then back at the road.
"We were going 70 miles an hour."
"How long have I been asleep?" When he didn't answer, she said, "I have a headache. I have a bad headache. How far are we from Carmel?"
"A couple of hours," he said.
"I'd like something to eat and some coffee. Maybe that'll make my head feel better," she said.
"We'll stop in the next town," he said.
She turned the rearview mirror and studied her face. She touched here and there under her eyes with her finger. Then she yawned and turned on the radio. She began to spin the knob. He thought about the pheasant. It had happened very fast, but it was clear to him he'd hit the bird deliberately.
"How well do you really know me?" he said.
"What do you mean?" she said. She let the radio alone for a minute and leaned back against the seat.
"I just said, how well do you know me?"
"I don't have any idea what you mean," he said.
"Just how well do you know me? That's all I'm asking."
"Why do you ask me that at this time of the morning?"
"We're just talking. I just asked you how well you knew me. Would I..."
How should he put it?
"Am I trustworthy, for instance? Do you trust me?"
It wasn't clear to him what he was asking, but he felt on the edge of something. "Is it important?" she said. She looked at him steadily. He shrugged.
If you don't think it is, then I guess it isn't.
He gave his attention back to the road. At least in the beginning, he thought, there'd been some affection. They began living together because she had suggested it, for one thing, and because at the time he'd met her, at the party of a friend in a Pacific Palisades apartment, he'd wanted the kind of life he imagined she could give him. She had money and she had connections. Connections were more important than money. But money and connections both, that was unbeatable. As for him, he was just out of graduate studies at UCLA, a drama major. Wasn't the city filled with them, though. And except for university theater productions, an actor without a salaried role to his credit. He was also broke. She was older by 12 years, had been married and divorced twice, but she had some money and she took him to parties where he met people. As a result, he'd landed a few minor roles. He could call himself an actor at long last, even if he didn't have more than a month or 2 months' work each year. The rest of the time, these last 3 years, he'd spent lying in the sun near her pool, or at parties, or else running here and there with Shirley.
Let me ask you this, then, he went on. Do you think I'd act, that I'd ever do something against my own best interests?
She looked at him and tapped a tooth with her thumbnail.
Well, he said.
It still wasn't clear to him where this might lead, but he intended to keep on with it.
Well, what? She said.
You heard me.
I think you would, Gerald. I think you would if you thought it was important enough at the time. Now don't ask me any more questions, okay? The sun was out now. The clouds had broken up. He began to see signs announcing various services in the next town. There was more traffic on the road. The wet fields on either side looked freshly green and sparkled in the early morning sun. She smoked her cigarette and stared out the window. She wondered if she should spend the energy to change the subject, but she was becoming irritated too. She was sick of this whole thing. It was too bad she'd agreed to come with him. She should have stayed in Hollywood. She didn't like people who were forever trying to find themselves, the brooding, introspective bit. Then she said,
"Look, look at those places," she exclaimed.
Out in the fields on their left were sections of portable barracks, housing for the farm workers. The barracks stood on blocks 2 or 3 feet off the ground, waiting to be trucked to another location. There were 25 or 30 such barracks. They had been raised off the ground and left standing so that some of the barracks faced the road and some of them were facing in other directions. It looked as if an upheaval had taken place.
"Look at that," she said as they sped past.
"John Steinbeck," he said. "Something out of Steinbeck."
"What?" she said.
"Oh, Steinbeck. Yes, that's right, Steinbeck."
He blinked his eyes and imagined he saw the pheasant. He remembered his foot punching down on the accelerator as he tried to hit the bird. He opened his mouth to say something, but he couldn't find any words. He was amazed, and at the same time deeply moved and ashamed at the sudden impulse which he'd acted upon to kill the pheasant. His fingers stiffened on the wheel.
"What would you say if I told you that I killed that pheasant intentionally? That I tried to hit it?"
She gazed at him for a minute without any interest. She didn't say anything. Something became clear to him then. Partly, he supposed later, it was a result of the look of bored indifference she turned on him, and partly it was a consequence of his own state of mind. But he suddenly understood that he no longer had any values. No frame of reference was the phrase that ran through his mind.
"Is it true?" she said.
He nodded.
"It could have been dangerous. It could have gone through the windshield. But it's more than that," he said.
"I'm sure it's more than that, if you say so, Jerry. But it doesn't surprise me if that's what you think."
"I'm not surprised," she said. "Nothing about you surprises me anymore.
You get your kicks, don't you?"
They were entering Potter. He cut his speed and began looking for the restaurant he'd seen advertised on the billboard. He located it a few blocks into the downtown area and pulled up in front onto the graveled parking area, but it was still early in the morning. Inside the restaurant, heads turned in their direction as he eased the big car to a stop and set the brake. He took the key from the ignition. They turned in the seat and looked at each other. "I'm not hungry anymore," she said. "You know something? You take away my appetite."
"I take away my own appetite," he said.
She continued to stare at him. "Do you know what you'd better do, Gerald? You'd better do something."
"I'll think of something."
He opened the car door and got out. He bent down in front of the car and examined the smashed headlamp and the dented fender. Then he went around to her side of the car and opened the door for her. She hesitated, then got out of the car. "Keys," she said. "The car keys, please." He felt as if they were doing a scene and this was the fifth or sixth take, but it still wasn't clear what was going to happen next. He was suddenly tired through to his bones, but he felt high, too, and on the edge of something. He gave her the keys. She closed her hand and made a fist. He said,
"I suppose I'll say goodbye then, Shirley, if that isn't too melodramatic."
They stood there in front of the restaurant.
"I'm going to try and get my life in order," he said. "For one thing, find a job, a real job. Just not see anybody for a while. Okay? No tears, okay? We'll stay friends if you want. We had some good times, right?"
"Gerald, you are nothing to me," Shirley said. "You're an ass.
You can go to hell, you son of a bitch."
Inside the restaurant, two waitresses and a few men in coveralls all moved to the front window to watch after the woman outside slapped the man on his cheek with the back of her hand. The people inside were at first shocked and then amused with the scene. Now the woman in the parking area was pointing down the road and shaking her finger. Very dramatic. But the man had already started walking. He didn't look back either. The people inside couldn't hear what the woman was saying, but they thought they had the picture since the man kept walking.
"God, she let him have it, didn't she?" one of the waitresses spoke up. "He got the boot and no mistake."
"He don't know how to treat them," said a trucker who had watched everything. "He should turn around and just knock the hell out of her."